About what happened in Salvador. President Trump made his first call to a foreign leader, Saudi Arabia. His second was to Bukele in El Salvador. And now Bukele, as Rubio is just leaving there, has promised to imprison American prisoners for a fee at the much admired by Trump, but horrified by human rights groups, prison system in El Salvador, and also to take deportees from any country. The significance of this.
Hi, it's great. It's great to be back with you. Look, I think in terms of the legal U.S. Courts question and international law, I'm not sure how that latter promise will play out, but what we can observe is that Bukele was close to Trump in his first term, and this is a way of cementing that closeness into a migration-driven alliance in his second term. From the rhetorical, where we saw a couple months ago, last June, to be exact, we saw Trump Jr., we saw Tucker Carlson and other figures in the MAGA sphere at Bukele's unconstitutional inauguration of his second term. And that was already on the rhetorical end. And then there's the anti-woke discourse that they share and a certain affinity rhetorically again. And then now they're moving more formally into the realm of migration cooperation. Now, in 2019, the Trump administration had negotiated with El Salvador a safe third country agreement. And this would clearly, at least on the rhetorical end, go much further than that. We'll have to see what actually, parsing the language a little bit, Rubio said that Bukele had offered to receive U.S. citizens convicted of crimes and incarcerated in the United States. But the other things were Bukele agreed to. So I think that the Tren de Aragua and MS-13 deportees are perhaps more immediately likely or possible than the latter.
And Roman, I wanted to ask you, of the five countries that Rubio is visiting, all of them have relatively conservative governments, with the exception of Guatemala. What do you expect? What's your sense of what Rubio hopes to get out of Guatemala and how that government may respond?
I think migration is the item of the day. Rubio will be arriving this afternoon, and he'll be here tomorrow. Excuse me. And tomorrow afternoon, he'll be giving a press conference summing up his Guatemala trip. The Arevalo administration is since the transition has been meeting with Trump officials and the Heritage Foundation to promote the idea that they can get along, and that As they told the U.S. press on background, I don't think they wanted to put a name to it, perhaps for optics, but they told the U.S. press on background that the Arevalo administration would be open to discussing the possibility of receiving regional return deportees. So I think on that plane, that will be a topic of discussion, and it's certainly of interest to Marco Rubio. But there's a broader political issue where the Arevalo administration has been trying to send the signal that they can get along, in part because the public prosecutor's office, which has been working to, which first worked to prevent Arevalo from taking office in January 2024, has now been working to, put him on trial, remove him from office, et cetera. And just last week, the Supreme Court decided to move forward with a probe of Arevalo that could possibly lead to the revocation of his immunity from prosecution. Anyhow, it's a very drawn out process, but the Supreme Court kicked the ball forward on that last week. So I think that domestic context is very important, given that the Attorney General and her office have been eagerly courting Trump's support and trying to promote the idea that they defend a conservative agenda.
And I'm wondering if we could look back at the broader picture of this indication of the Trump administration focusing on Latin America in its first days in office for the ostensibly over the migration crisis and fentanyl, but also over China's growing influence. Isn't the reality already that China has become the main economic partner of South America? It's the largest trading partner with South America and the second largest with Latin America as a whole. So really, the United States has been, for for now decades losing control of the markets of Latin America for its goods. Your sense of whether this has any impact on how the Trump administration is approaching the region?
Yeah, I think you're right about that. It does have Marco Rubio's fingerprint on it. And even in his recent Senate hearings during the Biden administration, he would frequently talk about Chinese influence in the region. Honduras broke relations with Taiwan 2 years ago, and Guatemala and Belize, which is part of the Commonwealth, the British Commonwealth, are the only two remaining countries. Now, Guatemala has kind of a balancing act where they maintain historic relations with Taiwan while also having informal commercial ties to China. And I think that could possibly be a topic of discussion for the visit too, especially given that Marco Rubio is very interested in China policy as it pertains to Central America and the broader region, as you pointed out.
And very quickly, Roman, Latin America, and particularly Central America, a place for the Trump administration to actually make money. You have President Trump's nominee to be Secretary of Commerce, Howard Lutnick, also has ties to El Salvador. He's the billionaire CEO of the Wall Street firm Cantor Fitzgerald, which is a major backer of Tether, a cryptocurrency firm that recently announced it's relocating to El Salvador. Bloomberg recently ran an article headlined, Commerce nominee Lutnick is backer of the outlaw's favorite cryptocurrency. The article states that Tether is used by, quote, drug traffickers, terrorists, and scammers to move money around the world. Your response, Roman?
I don't want to get in over my head on that. I wasn't aware of Lutnick's relationship, but it is true that Tether does have a presence in El Salvador and that an array of cryptocurrency companies, major players on the global scale, have had some type of presence in El Salvador since 2021, when the Bitcoin law was passed. Though I would note that the Bitcoin law was basically gutted in recent days. And for example, any language referencing Bitcoin as current or moneda or currency was struck from the law, among others, as part of an IMF financing deal. So I'm not sure what exactly the political implications would be of Lutnick's appointment, but we'll have to watch and see.
I also wanted to ask Miriam Pensack about Guantanamo. The Pentagon saying some 300 additional soldiers have arrived at the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, have begun constructing a tent city to detain up to 30,000 immigrants and asylum seekers. On Monday, the Cuban president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, condemned the Trump administration's attack on asylum seekers. This is what he said.
For Cuba, the violent and indiscriminate deportation of immigrants by the United States, arbitrary detentions, and other human rights violations are unacceptable. These measures are also used as a political pressure and blackmail weapon against the peoples of our America. The establishment of a detention center at the American Naval Base in Guantanamo, where it is intended to imprison tens of thousands of people, constitutes a barbaric act.
So that's the president of Cuba. Miriam Pensack, your forthcoming book is on Guantanamo. Can you give us the history of how the U.S. has used it?
Sure. So something that I should mention first and foremost is that before Guantanamo became what it was known for in the early 21st century, this sort of forever prison in the war on terror, the way that its ambiguous sovereignty as a U.S. base coercively held on Cuban soil functioned was to hold tens of thousands of circum-Caribbean asylum seekers, first from Haiti, roughly 40,000 from Haiti, then 35,000 Cubans who fled the island during the what was called the special period, so the collapse of the Soviet Union, which prompted the total collapse of Cuba's economy in the mid-90s. So this is actually a sort of back to basics, unfortunately, for Guantanamo. Those initiatives, first the Haitian internment and then the Baucedo crisis of Cuban rafters a few years later, what happened with the Haitians, they were by and large repatriated to extremely dangerous conditions in Haiti, where a coup had taken place against Haiti's first democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Cubans eventually made it to the United States. but not after, you know, after effectively being held in what were concentration camp, detention camp-like conditions in Guantanamo. And they were allowed into the United States because, in part because of the establishment of what became known as wet foot, dry foot.
Yeah, I also wanted to ask you about the Dominican Republic, where Rubio will also be visiting. The Dominican Republic has for years been involved in its own migration crackdown against Haitians within the country, massive attempts to deport Haitians from the DR. What do you sense might come out of Rubio's visit there?
I think there will definitely be a willingness to collaborate on immigration and deportation. You know, the Dominican Republic has been building a wall between itself and Haiti, which it shares, you know, the island of Hispaniola with. You know, there have been these mass attempts to deport Haitians. There have also been efforts to strip Dominican citizens of their citizenship if they have what has been in many cases very flimsy proof of Haitian origin or provenance. You know, so it's a very anti-black because Haiti was the first black republic and Haitians are, there are plenty of black Dominicans, I should say. But there is a huge degree of anti-blackness involved in that. And the Dominican Republic has in fact left some of its citizens who it deemed Haitian stateless because Haiti did not recognize them as Haitian citizens.
Marian Pensack, we want to thank you so much for being with us, historian of modern Latin America, postdoc fellow at Princeton University, writing a book on Guantanamo. Roman Gressier is French-American journalist based in Guatemala City, where he's the editor of El Faro English, host of the podcast Central America in Minutes. And Miriam was speaking to us from Panama City, where Secretary of State Rubio just was. Coming up, President Trump's threatening to deport pro-Palestinian student protesters. In a recent executive order, he urges schools to, quote, monitor and report activities by alien students. We'll speak with a student who was threatened with deportation at Cornell University and with an Israeli reporter, a conscientious objector, who just wrote a piece for Haaretz on deporting those who support justice in Palestine. Stay with us. الخربة الحزينة سلم لي عريحة وسلم عالديرة يطير الطير الأرض الكريمة يخدوش اللي فينا سلم لي عريحة وسلم عالديرة يطير الطير والجبال بلاقي انتمائي بين الشط والرمال بداية حياتي أحلق يا وطن فرحة ومآسي أحلق وطن الغالي فلسطين حبيبتنا featuring MC Abdul. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As President Trump hosts Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House today, we turn to an executive order Trump signed last week to combat, he said, anti-Semitism that has sent a chill across campuses. In a White House fact sheet accompanying the executive order, Trump threatened to deport non-citizen college students and other international visitors who take part in pro-Palestinian protests. Trump said, quote, to all the resident aliens who joined in the pro-jihadist protests, we put you on notice. Come 2025, we'll find you and we will deport you. I will also quickly cancel the student visas of all Hamas sympathizers on college campuses, which have been infested with radicalism like never before, Trump said. The executive order promises to, quote, marshal all federal resources to combat what it called the explosion of anti-Semitism on our campuses and streets, unquote, since October 7, 2023. It calls on the Secretary of Education to provide an inventory and analysis of all court cases involving anti-Semitism at colleges, university, and K through 12 schools within 60 days. The order requires colleges and universities to, quote, monitor for and report activities by alien students and staff that could be considered anti-Semitic or supportive of terrorism, potentially leading to their deportation. In response to Israel's 16th month military assault on Gaza, campuses across the U.S. erupted an unprecedented wave of pro-Palestinian protests in solidarity with Gaza. University administrations responded with a harsh crackdown. At least 3,000 people were arrested or detained during the height of the protests last year. Rights groups and legal scholars say the new executive order violates constitutional free speech rights and would likely draw legal challenges if implemented. For more on this executive order, we're going to two guests in Ithaca, New York. Mamadou Tal is with us, a PhD student in the Department of Africana Studies at Cornell University. Last year, Cornell suspended him for taking part in a campus protest calling on Cornell to divest from Israel. He faced deportation until Cornell allowed him to re-enroll after massive protests, thereby extending his visa. And Eitan Nechin is with us, the New York correspondent for Haaretz, where his recent piece is headlined, "We Will Find You and We Will Deport You, Why Trump's Executive Order on Anti-Semitism is So Dangerous." Eitan Nechin joins us from Washington, D.C., where he's covering protests of Netanyahu today at the White House. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Eitan, let's begin with you. Why do you say Trump's anti-Semitism executive order worries progressive Jewish groups, delights others, and you write that it is a major problem that he's threatening to deport students? As an Israeli, you write this.
Good morning, Amy. Good to be on. Well, this is dangerous not only for crushing dissent, but it's a deflection from what's going on in Israel and Palestine, right? So when we focus on students who are pro-Palestinian, who some, you know, said egregious things, it's all free speech. When you create a atmosphere that any dissent could be punished by deportation, that sends a chilling effect not only on foreign students, but on anyone who dares to criticize Israel, the administration. And this creates atmosphere that we have seen from authoritarian regimes, right? So this is basically a textbook authoritarian playbook meant to just stifle any criticism of what's going on in Israel. This campaign promise last year, and we've seen it's already been implementing even before. Right-wing Jewish group Beitar has already used AI to scrape social media to make lists of names of what they called Hamas supporters. This group just now recently attacked writer Peter Beinart for his new book about criticism of Israel. Peter Beinart is not a Hamas supporter, obviously. So this just shows the line of between free speech and a crackdown.
And who runs this Betar movement, and how did it arise?
Betar U.S. is part of Betar movement, which is founded in the 1920s by Jabotinsky, a very right-wing Zionist. And they have branches all over the world. So this is their U.S. branch. Also, there have been messaging on Jewish and Israeli text groups urging people to complain about anybody who's supporting Hamas. Again, the language in this order is so murky. What does it mean to be supportive of Hamas? Is it to wave a Palestinian flag? Because a lot of Israelis in protests have done so. Is it saying that, if somebody was at the right age, they would join a resistance movement, because that's what Ehud Barak said, former Prime Minister during his campaign in 1999. This is not justifying what Hamas did on October 7th, not at all. But this is the line between free speech and crackdown on authoritarianism. This is the aim and this is the goal.
I wanted to ask you about the Heritage Foundation's Project Esther, which claims yes. that a pro-Palestinian movement, that the pro-Palestinian movement here is a part of a global Hamas support network. And they issued a 33-page document that's suggesting revoking tax-exempt status for universities who host a pro-Palestinian protest. What's your reaction? Is that even feasible?
Right. This is, Project Esther is part of Project 2025, which aims, again, to, it varies through very vague language, crack down anybody who criticizes Israel as, you know, a terrorist supporter. And this is part of the administration's and the GOP's plan to crack down on nonprofits. And we've seen that last session where they tried to pass a bill. Basically gutting funding for nonprofit who support terrorism or whatever that language is, a bill that will be taken on this session. So this is part of a big crackdown on nonprofits and any human rights, speech rights, migrant rights. We've seen this across the board. Project Esther is one of the projects of 2025. Which centers around migration, centers around attacking of minorities on dissent on the left. And we've seen this after 9/11, obviously, when, protesters against the Iraq war were monitors supporting Al-Qaeda, right? The FBI had filed on people and nonprofits to try and stifle any dissent. This is part of the same playbook. What's more dangerous at this moment is Project 2025 and Elon Musk. I don't think there has been in the recent history such a tie between the government and a billionaire oligarch that basically has a run on the government and can do what his will. And where we've been seeing that since day one.
We're talking to Eitan Netchen, who is the New York correspondent for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. He's in Washington, D.C. today to cover the protests against Netanyahu. It's his first visit to the United States, to the White House, since the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for him for crimes against humanity. There were two other presidents who came to the inauguration, Boo of Ecuador and the right-wing president of Argentina, but this is the first official White House visit that Trump is having Netanyahu. They are close personal friends. We're also joined by Mamadou Tal, PhD student in the Department of Africana Studies at Cornell University, almost deported last year after being temporarily suspended for his pro-Palestine activism. Mohammed, if you can talk about what happened to you, we would report your story in headlines. There was tremendous outcry and pressure on Cornell to remove the suspension so you wouldn't be deported. Explain what happened.
Yes. So we partook in a protest at Statler Hotel on Cornell's campus. And in that career fair, which was taking place at Statler Hotel, there was Boeing and L3 Harris, who are targets of our divestment campaign, because we know that L3 Harris and Boeing are directly involved in shipments and armaments of Israelis' genocide against the Palestinian people. We eventually brought the careers fair to a standstill. And about a few days later, I was told that I was suspended. And someone on the F1 visa, being suspended means that you lose your student status, which triggers the loss of your visa, effectively being deported, being asked to leave the country. I was told in that meeting that I will have about 48 hours to leave the country. With, as you said, public pressure, support, Cornell University back down, and I'm allowed to finish my degree. However, I am still banned from campus. I'm allowed in one building on campus to work. I have to fight to be able to get library access. And I think there's somewhat of a great irony that students who are protesting apartheid are now subject to forms of exclusion, bordering, and apartheid, with our movements restricted, and we're only allowed to go to designated places on campus.
And how has your work and as a graduate student continued to be affected since the university rescinded your suspension?
It continues to be impacted because, first and foremost, I'm excluded from campus life. I was teaching a class to undergrads, which was effectively banned from teaching. My class was taken away from me, which everyone knows is a huge part of progression with your degree. My movements remain restricted. I had to fight, as I said, to be able to use the library, to have work from the library, right? To be able to go onto campus and to use certain access of certain parts of campus. Right now, as I said, I'm still only allowed in one building on campus. To demonstrate the egregious nature of this, I had to even fight with the university to say, if I use Cornell Health, go to see a doctor. Initially, I was told I have to inform them every single time I have a doctor's appointment to be allowed onto campus.
Mamadou, can you respond to Trump's executive order as he talks about alien students being deported? Your colleagues at Cornell and other places that you're hearing from, what kind of effect that this has had? And also, I mean, you were born in Gambia. You are a British citizen. Why you support the Palestinians and were involved in those protests?
Thank you for both those questions. For the first one, of course, the executive orders, the language in which the framing and the language of the executive orders clearly are targeting pro-Palestinian protesters, international students. And I think they're intended to have a chilling effect on Palestinian protests, pro-Palestinian protesters, in order for them to stop protesting at the threat of deportation. The message that is being sent out is, if you are an international student who comes here legally, then you should not be involved in exercising your First Amendment right, or you will be subject to deportation. And that is the intended effect. I don't think it's going to work. I think, if anything, when fascism is at the door, what we do is come together and unite even stronger. However, as for your second question, I think fundamentally, yes, I'm Gambian. Yes, I'm British. But fundamentally, I'm a human being. And I think what Palestine does, when we say Palestine is a litmus test, we're saying that it is not that we privilege the Palestinian cause among over every other cause, but rather Palestine holds a mirror up into the world and says, what kind of world do we want to live in? Do you want to live in a world in which every single international multilateral institution is rubbish? Do you want to live in a world where the ICC and the ICJ are rendered defunct and the UN rendered defunct, and there's no such thing as an international cooperation of a world, and people are able to do, and leaders are able to act in any way they see fit and kill women and children and men and boys and enact genocide? So I think fundamentally why I get involved is because I'm a human being. And finally, I will end with, the university was presented with a crossroad. That crossroad, will they protect those students? They failed initially by suspending so many people. Again, now with Trump's presidency, the university is presented with another crossroad. And I'm calling on the university to not just be a bystander, but take an active position, an active role to defend their students and say, we're not going to allow Trump and right-wing fascists and outside agencies to come onto campuses and collect foreign students.
Mamadou, we have to leave it there. Mamadou Tal was threatened with deportation. That was during the Biden administration, and now it faces this executive order by Trump. And I want to thank Eitan Netchen. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
What is the forest industry most afraid of? Shifting the conversation from saving old growth to protecting what's left of BC's primary forests, areas with minimal human disturbance and far greater ecological value than tree farms. Save What's Left Conservation Society is a volunteer-run group at the forefront of the movement to save the last remnants of unprotected primary forest through seeking reforms to the government agency, BC Timber Sales. Learn more at savewhatsleft.ca, Find us on social media and please support our vital work through our website.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.